Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, welcome to the Portrait of a Lady on Fire podcast. I'm Steph Watts, and this is an hour of audio swooning brought to you by Curzon at the film that has had critics declaring undying love and using fire emojis more than any other before it, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Set in the 18th century, it's a story of women, art, women's art, and a fiery romance that burns between artist and subject. The film is the fourth directorial effort from French director Céline Sciamma, and we're going to be investigating some fascinating things about it. We'll be looking at the provocative and timely stories Sciamma has told already.
100,000 children watched it before a right-wing contingent started to get nervous about it and think of it as indoctrination.
Why being a working artist in the 18th century was so important for women.
We'd say, why is marriage the inevitable destiny?
What it's actually like to have to paint someone's portrait for hours on end, especially when they're a film director.
Who can say they've watched Ridley Scott's favourite film with him?
And what does Céline Sciamma herself think about all of this?
It's not about me giving up on power, it's about what do you do with your power and how do you share it.
Céline Sciamma is undoubtedly one of the most important European directors working today. Since her debut film Water Lilies in 2007, she has produced quiet revolutions on screen, telling stories that are rarely told and doing so in groundbreaking ways, challenging conceptions of sexuality, gender, identity and love. Last year, having recently won the Queer Palm and the Best Screenplay prizes at Cannes Film Festival, Portrait of a Lady on Fire had become one of the most anticipated films at the BFI London Film Festival. Director of Festivals for the BFI, Tricia Tuttle, told us why Sciamma's films are so important, as well as taking us on a journey through all of her work up to this point. First of all, though, who is Céline Sciamma?
Céline Sciamma is a French filmmaker. Portrait of a Lady on Fire is her fourth feature film. Her first feature film was 2007, Beautiful Water Lilies, which was actually written, she went to La Famille, the famous French film school, where she studied as a screenwriter. And she wrote the script for Water Lilies as her graduation project, not necessarily intending to direct it. But on graduation, she was encouraged by Xavier Beauvoir, who was one of the tutors, to make the film herself. And within 6 months after graduating, she raised the finance and found herself making the film. Went on to play in Certain Regard at Cannes, did very well, and really started to make her name. And thank goodness she's discovered that she also wants to direct. So that was her first film. You know, she started as a literature student, so she's incredibly well read. And she, when she talks about work that's influenced her, she as often as, you know, not talks about writers who've been a big influence. So Simone de Beauvoir was a massive influence on her. She referenced in terms of her inspiration for Water Lilies, one is not born a woman but becomes one. And I think her first three films are very much about the act of becoming who you are going to be. And she is also, like, spent her youth, I think, retreating into the cinema. She talks about discovering movies as a 13-year-old and used to take herself off to see films, French coming-of-age films. She talks about Noemi Lvovsky, Pilar. I mean, she, I think, is very loves cinema, but also watches a wide range of international cinema as well.
When we see someone's first film, we have no idea where their career will take them, what directions a mere freshman flourishes compared to long-standing themes reflected throughout a body of work. When we look back on the debut from a director, we often see their first tango with the ideas that will come to define their filmography.
You can see in that first film, Water Lilies, preoccupations that you see throughout her whole work. The act of looking is very big. Gender presentation is very big. What it means to be a woman is something, that, a theme that she keeps coming back to again and again. But Water Lilies is a really interesting film. It's her only film shot on celluloid, shot on 35mm, and working with a female cinematographer, which she's done on all four of her feature films.
And it's not just female cinematographers that Siyama works with on her films. Behind the camera, her crews are full of female creativity. Portrait of a Lady on Fire sees Claire Maton as cinematographer, Christelle Barra as casting director, Dorothée Guiraud as costume designer, and Véronique Kyler and Bénédicte Couvreur as producers. And that's just a small number of the female collaborators Siyama has brought to all her projects, starting with her debut, Water Lilies.
It's a film about a young girl, and she's talked about it as being partly autobiographical, young girl in the suburbs outside of Paris who is starting to question her own sexuality. It happens by chance on a synchronized swimming practice and becomes really obsessed with synchronized swimming as a sort of beautiful sport that she wasn't aware of, but also becomes really interested in the captain of the swim team, who is played by Adèle Hanel, a character called Flora. And the main character, Marie, becomes fascinated with her and is, through her interest in Florian, starts to question her own sexuality. But it's such an interesting film, not just about sort of teenage, emergence of teenage sexuality and the sort of changing period of being a teenager, but it's also the first film where you really see this interest in gender construction. And the central metaphor of the film is such an interesting metaphor. Synchronized swimming is a sport almost exclusively played by women. In France, it's a sort of female-only sport, and it is an activity where the body presents very differently above the water than it does under the water. It's a sport where women have to be poised and beautiful, and underneath the water, their legs are working furiously to keep them above the water. And Celine has also spoken about watching some of this, and women sort of leave the pool and have to throw up because it's so intense to have to do it. But that's such a beautiful, simple metaphor for what she was trying to explore in the film.
And those ideas begin to cross over into her next film, Tomboy, which continues to question gender expectations through the lens of a younger character and in a style that is accessible to viewers of the same age.
Tomboy, her second feature, 2011, is set in the world of children. There's very little interaction with adults in the film. There's a mother who plays a small part in the film, but it really is, like lots of her films, it's a hermetically sealed world for the characters to sort of interact with each other. And this is the world of children. The central character is a character called Lara, who presents as Mikkel. She takes the opportunity of moving to a new town to start to explore her gender and project herself as a young boy called Mikkel, and of course passes, and it's about gender performance like Water Lilies and in a different kind of way. The film was presented to young children in France, and it was actually used in schools as a way to talk about gender and identity. Apparently, you know, 100,000 children watched it before a sort of right-wing contingent started to get nervous about it and think of it as indoctrination, so sort of stopped that from happening. But it's a film that, you know, that children can and do watch. And actually, I watched it with my son when it came out as well, too. And he really, really loved it. And it made him think a lot about the presentation of gender. And actually, it was made in 2011, very progressive, very ahead of its time in lots of ways. We're talking a lot more about non-binary identity and transgender identity. And that in 2011 was something that she was exploring out ahead of the cultural conversation around it.
After Tomboy comes Girlhood, the third in Siama's coming-of-age trilogy that began her career. This film deservedly brought her talents further into the spotlight and gave every audience member a newfound love of Rihanna's diamonds. It marks a clear development on the way to her latest film as well.
Girlhood is, I think, moving her more towards Portrait of a Lady on Fire, where she is being very precise in the way she wants to structure her film and tell her story, and tell her story in sort of bite-sized pieces. So in Girlhood, it is a film set in five chapters, and each one is very different. It's also her only film that she shot in CinemaScope. It's a beautiful, big, widescreen film where characters move across the screen, and the screen pans across many characters. Four central characters in the film. It's a film about a young woman in the suburbs of Paris who is starting to discover who she is, and she meets a group of friends that she becomes very tight with, and through that friendship starts to discover more about her own identity. It's also a film, probably more than any of her other films until Portrait, that is about looking and the act of representation. There's a beautiful scene that everybody knows from Girlhood, which is set to Rihanna's Diamonds. And the film structurally moves the viewer through different positions of looking. We start with one of the main characters, Lady, dancing by herself in the frame, and then several of the other girls join her in the frame. Vic, the main character, is still watching them, and then Vic joins, and the moment Vic joins, the sound changes so that she enters the frame in such a sort of beautiful, considered way. And I think she was starting to test ideas around the filmic gaze in Girlhood that you can really see fully developed in Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
The gaze is pivotal to all of Siama's work. Her films place us as both the viewer and viewed, but never has it been more pronounced than in Portrait of a Lady on Fire. The film is set in late 18th century France. Painter Marianne, played by Noémie Merlant, is commissioned by an affluent countess to paint the wedding portrait of her sheltered but headstrong daughter Héloïse, in the hope that it will find her a wealthy husband. Héloïse is played by Adèle Haenel, who appeared in Siama's debut Water Lilies as well. Héloïse refuses to sit for the portrait, so while posing as her hired companion, Marianne is instructed to complete the portrait in secret, observing Héloïse by day and painting her by night. However, as the two women grow closer, their intimacy and attraction begins to blossom, paving the way for a simmering, sensual, exquisite romance. Whilst we might know the awkwardness of posing, or waiting for someone to pose for a hopefully flattering Instagram photo, the filter of a real portrait painting is a far more artistic, time-consuming and intimate process than a quick phone swipe. But what is it like today to actually commission and produce a portrait?
Artists, I remember sitting in on the commission. Shirin Neshat made a portrait of Malala for us, and I was there for the commission and the shoot.
This is Lucy Dalson. Lucy worked at the National Portrait Gallery for 5 years, where she was the curator of contemporary portraiture.
And it was very interesting being there for the sitting and watching the dynamic between Malala and Shirin. And then seeing the final portrait completely... It was completely different because it was seen from Shirin's perspective, not mine. And again, we come back to that idea of thinking about the objective, what a portraiture should look like.
I always get quite a lot of adrenaline during the sitting. It's like you're going into an exam or something.
And this is Nina May Fowler. Nina and Lucy met when the National Portrait Gallery commissioned Nina to produce a collection of portraits of British film directors.
And then you come out and you think, what just happened? You know? Or you read that essay later that you wrote in the exam and you think, I don't even know how I... Where that came from. After each of the sittings, I felt this huge sort of adrenaline rush sort of seep out of me. And then I'd take all the information back to my studio and just digest it. And, you know, that's the time when you really just, you've got to do your best by the sitter.
Yeah.
And for the commissioner as well. And it's like you said, as you are in the position of, you know, making the project happen, I actually thought the mother in the film was quite relaxed, you know, because I've done a lot of portrait commissions, and actually to be given those 5 days to just get on with the work when she went off to Italy and said, I'll be back in 5 days, I thought, well,
that's
at least she's not sort of asking for progress reports and, you know, checking up every evening on how it's
going.
But it can be.
Nina's exhibition comprised 8 portraits. Amma Asante, Paul Greengrass, Asif Kapadia, Ken Loach, Sam Mendes, Nick Park, Joe Wright, and Sir Ridley Scott.
It was a long process deciding on the list of sitters.
We wanted it to be current, so you had a lot of patience.
In a project that would take over 5 years to complete, Nina travelled the world to meet a carefully compiled list of directors who would sit for a collection titled Luminary Drawings.
And I had this horrible realisation in the film that I am the comptess. And the kind of... I guess the role of the gallery is quite difficult, because you come up with the ideas and you're there to facilitate and support the artist and sitter, but then it's really, really important that you let creative processes happen, because it's got to come from a person, hasn't it? You know, and I think that's really beautiful what you're saying about how the film directors trusted you, let you do it.
Just like Marianne in Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Nina travelled alone to visit each of the sitters.
It was a real challenge for me technically, because I wanted to make them in charcoal, because I wanted to get that intense black of the cinema.
Nina's known for her large-scale portraits that interrogate themes of celebrity, beauty, power and sexuality. A perfect match for film directors, really.
I ended up coming up with the idea of having a little portable cinema, because I knew that I'd have to travel to a lot of the directors, and some of them I only had about 30 minutes with. So to capture someone in that small time frame, you know, for forever, you know, they're going to be in the archive of the museum. They need real longevity. It's hard. So I had this idea that I'd arrive to wherever they were, whether it was Shepperton Studios or New York I had to go to, or Cotswolds, or I did travel a lot. I would arrive with this little portable cinema, which I would set up, so all the lighting, everything was the same, and the director would have previously chosen a film of great importance to them, so that could have been anything, and I made it very clear that that film choice would never be revealed, for a couple of reasons, mainly because, like you mentioned, I wanted to keep the mystery. The beauty for me of that idea was I knew the directors were going to get lost within 5 minutes, because the film that they all chose, well, they all chose a different film, although I will tell you that two of them chose the same film, not giving too much away, but... because the film was of such importance to them, it's the same as anyone. What, you know, we all know that film that changed our life, or affected the way we thought about something, or affected what we want to do in life, or just a film that we really love to watch, and a film that we really get lost in. So I arrived with my little cinema, I would project the film of their choice, and in many instances they hadn't seen the film for years as well, because again, in life, when do you get the time to revisit all your favourite films? It's hard. So I would put on their film, and luckily within about 5 minutes they were all totally engrossed by the film, and they were lit only by the light of the screen, the reflected light. So I had the setup where I would film them watching the film. So, and I was also sketching as well, which was quite difficult because it was dark. So I was sort of sketching blindly, but that was okay because in that instance, the reason for sketching really is just to observe their face. And I always find you can take as many pictures as you want, but it's not until you actually start drawing and looking, drawing from life, that you really start observing how someone's face works and is, you know, the shapes and the tones. And so I spent the time drawing, they spent the time watching, and I think they all forgot that I was there. They all were you know, so enraptured by watching the film. Some, a lot of them, 80% of them decided to stay for the whole film, which was lovely because
gave you a bit more time.
Gave me more time. And you know, some of them cancelled meetings because they were enjoying the film so much. They said, "I just want to stay here." And I had a little sort of picnic for them as well, popcorn and drinks and a comfy chair. And so they were sort of in heaven, I think. And you know, and each one of them after the sitting said, "Thank you for giving me this time." You know, in the middle of a very busy day or week or whatever, they said, "This has just been such a break."
It remains a secret. Nina stayed true to her promise. But while we can't know what they picked, we do get a little insight.
Something that I was really interested in was you talking about the reasons that different directors picked the different films that they did. And I think you said that Sally Potter picked a film consciously thinking about how she would react to that film.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Thinking about Portrait of a Lady and why we're here again talking about portraiture and contemporary commissioning and film.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's this tension between taking agency, the subject of the portrait taking agency and how they want to be represented. And that was really interesting to me, thinking that she didn't, well, I don't know if it was her favourite film, you know that, but thinking very consciously about what her reaction to that film would be.
Yeah. Well, it makes a huge difference, I have to say, when you're portraying creatives, creative people, because they tend to give you benefit of the doubt, because they understand from, you know, being a creative person that you're probably going to get better results from someone creative if you're not too stringent with guidelines. So I was very fortunate that they were all very relaxed about letting me do what I wanted. Basically, I mean, I assume they all looked at my work and had some degree of faith that I was going to do an okay job. But as you said, it was very interesting how Sally Potter, as a creative person, almost projected herself onto my position as the artist and thought about what I was going to see and what she was going to... you know, how she was going to come across and react. So she said she chose one film to begin with, but she changed her mind because in that film she knew she was going to laugh too much and it made her feel really happy and celebratory.
Yeah.
And she didn't necessarily want her portrait to be like that. So she ended up choosing a film that moved her really deeply. And she was there for the whole film. And that was the other wonderful thing about this commission, was that I got to watch the films with these incredible directors, you know, which is, I mean, who can say they've watched, you know, Ridley Scott's favourite film with him, you know,
and
or Sally Potter or Amorous Auntie.
Oh,
yeah, and they had a great time because they talked all the way through. You know, it wasn't strict in that they had to sit still.
Amazing.
Which... So she really, I mean, she was the most sort of reactive Sally Potter, and she has a history of performance. She's a dancer. And she, by the end, I was just mesmerized watching her because she was really moved, deeply moved by the end of this film. And she was one of the hardest because I had so many wonderful images of her to choose from. And when she saw her portrait, I decided to use her hands in the portrait. And when she saw the drawing for the first time, she decided to wait until she saw it in the museum, not look at pictures of it. So she saw it and I was with her. And she said that her hands really reminded her of her grandma's hands in a really positive way. She says you never see your hands from that angle. You know, you only ever see your hands looking down at them.
Of course.
Unless they're in a photograph. But she'd never seen her hands from the angle I drew them. And she was really stunned at how much they looked like her grandmother's hands. And that brought her a real feeling of happy nostalgia. And that was a lovely thing to hear. And Amma Asante as well, she commented that looking at her portrait, she felt like she did when she was a small girl. It reminded her of herself at sort of age 4 or 5, sitting on her father's lap.
Oh, amazing.
So, you know, obviously these lovely strong reactions to the portraits. It was a huge compliment to me.
So the sitter is a performer. A portrait artist might observe more than they direct, but regardless, they still elicit a performance from their subject. How does this process translate in cinema?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Celine has talked about the fact that she told her characters where to exhale, you know, on a line of dialogue. She knew how many steps that, or they together decided how many steps they would move through a scene. It's a 2-hour film nearly, but it's 69 scenes, which are very precisely structured. She actually worked on the film. It took 5 years from girlhood to the making of this film. And you can see that kind of thought and consideration.
Although Marianne might be the artist we see on screen, we can't help but think of the film as an artwork from Siama, using her own tools of looking to examine the nature of viewership within artistic practice. What does the film have to say about that gaze?
It's a film that interrogates the act of looking from both the looker and the person who's being looked at. There's a great scene in the middle of the film where Eloise has discovered that she's being painted, and she forces Marianne to start a new painting that she's actually going to sit for, to make it more truthful and to allow her personality to come out more in the film. And after hours of sitting, Marianne says, I don't envy you having to be in this position. And Eloise turns to her and says, but you're in exactly the same position that I am. Who do you imagine that I look at all day when you watch me? And it's such a beautiful scene, which turns the sort of passive subject, the idea of the passive subject, totally on its head. There's so many moments where we're invited to look, and she invites us to look by doing startling things within the frame. There's quite a few scenes where a character is in a frame and another character moves behind them, and you realise that it's more than one person, and that the sort of self-consciousness of that, or the sort of constructedness of that, asks us to step back and pay attention to who we're being looked at and how we're being asked to look. I think my favourite scene from the film, which is actually two scenes put together, and I don't think I breathed the entire time, was the sequence that starts with all of the women around the campfire, and Marianne and Eloise are looking at each other across the fire, and Eloise's dress goes on fire. It's the sort of central image of the film. It's the painting image that opens the film and takes us back to this moment. And Eloise, instead of panicking because her dress is on fire, looks down at her dress and falls on the ground, and you don't breathe at all. And then the next scene you see is the two of them on the beach, and they can't speak because they've got scarves around their mouth, and it is just a breathlessly beautiful scene about looking, and the two characters having looked at each other, now really allowing each other to look and see each other at the same time.
For a film that really only has three principal cast members set in a remote location, there really is so much going on and just so many fascinating conversations that have sprung from it.
It's about the erasure of female artists, writers, painters, filmmakers, and the fact that women have been erased from these sort of cultural and creative histories also means that certain stories have been erased.
Talking about not being allowed to paint male figures as a female painter because it's not allowed, and I think she says it's to stop women making great art, that they're not allowed to paint men. But then in this whole film you're seeing women creating art all the time, they're creating music. You even have Sophie, the maid, kind of embroidering these beautiful patterns onto cloth, and there's just always kind of women creating things, even when for the time they're not technically kind of allowed to make great art.
This is something that came up as well when we were doing the commission for the MPG, because we obviously wanted to represent women in the series of portraits, but it also needed to be representative of, the
film industry.
The film industry at the same time. So I was very aware of, there being a good balance of women in the series.
And it being reflective of reality.
Exactly.
Much like all other aspects of work, portrait art mostly saw women sidelined. But centuries ago, for a minority, portraiture could be that rare thing, established work for women.
The big problem for women, as well as the big opportunity for women, one of them in the 18th century, which is marriage.
And to tell us more about what women's art would have been like during the 18th century, we spoke to Jenny Batchelor, Professor of 18th Century Studies at the University of Kent. Jenny has written extensively on women's writing, women's work, and the craft and history of the dress.
Well, I mean, the film is very much about... It's about memory and remembering, and about forgetting, and how both of things happen, how we remember and how we forget. And of course, that's really important in terms of when we think back about 18th century women artists, because there were a very good number of them, and yet many are not popularly very well known today, which is a great shame. The situation at the time, broadly speaking, was that all women of a certain class, sort of middle class and upwards, were expected to have some kind of competency in drawing, drawing like being able to run a household or being able to dance or play music. These were all accomplishments that were expected of women of those classes at the time. But of course, to be a professional artist is a very, very different proposition. And it is open to a good number of women, but a very exceptional group of women. And they're exceptional for a number of reasons. Then the women from that period who did become very successful portrait painters across Europe, so I'm thinking about people like Elizabeth Vigée Le Brun in France, who was, amongst other things, a very popular portrait painter, particularly of portraits of the Queen Marie Antoinette in France, or the Swiss-born Angelika Kaufmann, who was like a Europe-wide sensation and one of the founding members of the Royal Academy in London, one of two women out of a very many more men who were founding members of the Royal Academy at the time. These women were exceptional for a number of reasons. One, they had some exceptional opportunities. Both those women had fathers who were involved in the art world, although actually neither of them as successful as their daughters would become. They also had access to certain kinds of networks. That's really important for women trying to enter into the profession of art in this period, to have access to networks of individuals, both for training, but also to have opportunities to exhibit your work and so forth. So, you could have all the talent in the world, but if you didn't have some of those opportunities, then it really wasn't going to take you very far. Having patrons, people who would help advance your cause, was really important too. But But even so, there were still barriers. So even some of the most successful women artists of this time, and this is something that is picked up on in the film, you know, aren't really able to produce work in certain genres. So history painting, for example, is very much a kind of masculine artistic form in this period, although actually Angelica Kaufmann did do some history paintings. But there's all sorts of prejudices against women artists in this period, even those who were very celebrated. So for instance, one of the key problems, and Marianne talks about this in the film, is that women aren't supposed to have the kind of access to training in drawing male anatomy, for instance. They can't be taught how to draw bodies in sessions where they have a male sitter. And that's a big problem, particularly for history painting. I mean, Kaufmann got around that problem by using sculpture as a kind of proxy for the male body that enabled her then to produce those kind of arts. So there were real challenges. And other artists, even though they were very famous, you know, female artists, when their work was exhibited, it was subject to a kind of scrutiny or certain kinds of criticisms that, you know, just wouldn't really usually be levelled against their male contemporaries. So Vigée Le Brun, for instance, was famously metaphorically rapped on the knuckles for having portraits of women who were smiling. God forbid women should smile in a portrait, and really God forbid that they should actually show their teeth, which indeed some of her portrait sitters do, and one of her self-portraits does as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really complicated situation. There are some exceptional women in this period, a good number of them, who were very talented, who were very influential and widely celebrated. It's a travesty that they're not better known popularly today, but I guess that's one of the things that this movie is about, really, is trying to retrieve those memories and celebrate them again. But it's also true that, you know, those women were exceptional because they had exceptional obstacles to overcome.
The artist in Portrait of a Lady on Fire is Marianne, whose lifestyle runs against the grain of the typical roles for women, particularly ones we're used to seeing in period films. She's a bit of a loose cannon. Would there really have been a Marianne at that time?
There are certainly characters in the literature of the period who question the destinies of those other women that you talk about. I mean, given her situation, service is not really an option. She wouldn't have been a servant unless something dreadful happened to her, although that does happen in 18th century novels sometimes. Families fall on hard times and women are forced into service. But really her only other option, it would have been to accept marriage and to live not the life of a professional artist. But yes, there are absolutely women in novels of this time who question the fact that marriage is the automatic destiny for marriage and motherhood are the automatic destinies for women. So she is a loose cannon. One of the reasons why she's a loose cannon is that it's not just that she rejects that alternative, but she looks to a profession as the alternative to marriage. The fact that she seeks to carve out a life for herself through her life as an artist, that I think is somewhat distinctive at this particular time, because traditionally almost all of the professions, apart from art, are inaccessible to women. Medicine, the law, obviously the church, they're not available to women. So really the only profession at this time which is technically available to women, albeit with all sorts of obstacles in their way, is art. And her desire to pursue that is absolutely distinctive, I think. But I think her general, the ambition and the questions that are posed by the way she chooses to live her life are absolutely of a keeping with novels of the time and certain women who were starting ever more insistently in the latter part of the 18th century to say, why is marriage the inevitable destiny for women like me?
And what about 18th century LGBTQ stories?
Well, of course, I mean, the language is totally different. They can't refer to gay relationships. Queer has a very different meaning in this period, and they don't talk about lesbianism either. But absolutely, same-sex bonds between women are celebrated in novels of this time in ways that we might retrospectively read as gay or queer relationships. One of the things that really struck me about the film, and I wondered whether this was somehow in the minds of the filmmakers as they were coming up with the story, is there are a number of novels, particularly in the sort of 1790s, so a bit later than this film, that try to imagine what life might be like for women in the absence of men.
A world without men? For 95% of Portrait of a Lady on Fire, that certainly is the case. Perhaps a world without men is something that Siama pondered when putting the film together. Maybe it's time that we actually heard from the director herself.
Well, I wanted to make a film dedicated to a love story.
We spoke to her after a screening at the London Film Festival last year, starting at the very beginning with the importance behind the title of the film.
Wanted to mix a love dialogue with a creative dialogue and thought about that relationship between the model and the artist. And you know, the title came pretty early in the process, was actually came in like a flash. Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Portrait d'une jeune fille en feu. And then the images came also. Like, okay, this is not a metaphor. We are really going to set fire to the character. And I think it talks a lot about the film. It's not only poetic ideas. It's about embodying and about being very, very generous and creating new images.
How does Portrait of a Lady on Fire bring modern politics to a period setting and vice versa?
Yeah, the movie will definitely be something that, you know, is said in 2019. Yet I really didn't want to wink at the past from the present or wink at the present from the past. It's really not anachronistic at all. I did a lot of research. We all did, the whole team, regarding the sets, the costumes, and also the lives and the work of this women painter. That's actually why I picked this particular moment of the 18th century, second half of the 18th century, because there were hundreds of women painters at the time. Was totally ignorant of that, and when I encountered that reality and their body of work, definitely gave the urge to set the movie at that time, because stories that haven't been told, they definitely belong to the present. Yet really, it is not anachronistic at all. And I feel like the bridges, the transmission that there is between these past women and the women of today is mostly like there's, I think the intimacy is the same. I think, you know, even though these women were oppressed and couldn't get the opportunity to be, I don't know, artists and to love who they want to love. Still, you know, it's not because you're not allowed to run that you don't want to run. It's not because you're not allowed to love that you don't have this crazy desire for somebody. And so I think this is, some of it is still, a lot of it is still true regarding the intimacy.
We've heard from Nina May Fowler about the relationship between artist and subject. And in the film, the portrait itself becomes a collaborative piece between Marianne and Eloise. What was the collaboration process between Siama and Adele and Noemi, who play those characters?
The movies really wanted to get rid of this idea of the muse with this silent, fetishized woman being inspiring just because she's beautiful. Actually, being the model was kind of the only opportunity the women were given to be in the workshop and to create art. And they seized that opportunity. They were one of the brains in the room. And we have this mythology of the greatest artist expressing himself, which I think is not true to the actual process. I've heard of Dora Maar. She was the muse of Picasso. She was one of the founder of the Surrealists. She was maybe the most gifted. And we weren't told that.
What was the collaboration process between Siama and her lead actors, Adele and Noemi?
The movie talks about this and the collaboration between the model and the painter. And obviously, we work the same way. It's not about, you know, cinema is a very, there's a lot of hierarchy, and obviously the director is the boss. You have a lot of power, but it's not about me giving up on power. It's about what do you do with your power and how do you share it. So we've had a very, very strong collaborative relationship also with the DP, Claire Maton, director of photography, a very horizontal gaze, a lot of circulation. And, you know, even the fact that the movie is so meta in a way, I would look at Adele. Noemi would look at how I look at Adele to perform the painter, and you know, Claire Maton would look at Noemi looking at Adele, and it was also really fun and joyful because we were of course fully aware of that circulation. And I think movies look a lot like the way they are made, and so you can totally feel this the type of collaboration we have.
Like Rihanna in Girlhood, there is one song that has captured people's hearts again in Portrait of a Lady on Fire, the presto from Summer in Vivaldi's Four Seasons. Celine Sciamma has said that it's much cheaper to get Vivaldi than it is Rihanna. But more importantly, how does the sound in the film affect the stillness and intensity of the images?
That was a decision that I took very, very early on in the process of writing to make a film without music. It's a decision you have to take because then it's going to influence the writing because it's not the same rhythm. You won't leave room for the music. And the film has to find its melody, its musicality elsewhere. So you have to think a lot about that because then you have to think about the sound. It was a challenge because, you know, love stories, of course, are always about the soundtrack. You know, we can play the game where I'll be telling you a movie and you'll go with the soundtrack, like Dirty Dancing, Time of My Life. But it wasn't about that being challenging. You know, I'm not trying to put traps for myself. It's just it was mostly about the reconstitution. I wanted to put the audience in the same position as the character. And they're missing beauty, they're missing art in their life. And the film is also about how love is an education to the arts and how art is also consoling. And so if the audience would hear a score when they would actually lack music in their life, that would be devastating, I think. And also wanted to connect the people to... Yeah, that when music and beauty burst, it's we believe strongly in music and cinema. That's why when this time we decided not to put much, so that the emotion would be the biggest.
As well as that Vivaldi track, there's another moment that is striking for its musical accompaniment, performed by a group of women around a bonfire.
Yeah, we decided to compose this original song. I've done research about, you know, the melodies at the time, and some of the song we're still singing to our children when we have some. But really wanted to create this anthem for the film that would totally belong, and also that, you know, also that could maybe become an anthem for something else in life. And so I wanted polyphonia, polyrhythmy, and no instruments, just the voice and the bodies of these women. And it's the actual composer of all the music of my film, Parawan, who crafted it with Arthur Simonini. And it was... The idea was that it should be a trance, so that the BPMs would have to be very, very, very high.
And as well as creating a musical track that's a trance, Sciamma ultimately made a film that's a trance, beguiling and beautiful, and one rich in images that will stick long in the mind of anyone who watches it, and one that raises so perfectly the value and importance of women's art.
The film is trying to question what we value about women's activities, women's art, women's aspirations now and in the past. And that's something that comes through very well. You know, women's art, women's craft has historically not been valued or even talked about in the same vocabulary that we tend to talk about men's artistic and creative and craft sort of achievements. And that's something this film is really asking us to think about. Why is that the case? Why should that be the case?
So if you're wondering what film you should watch next, don't let another beautiful piece of women's art go undervalued. Portrait of a Lady on Fire is out in cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema now, and you should watch it as soon as possible. Big thanks to all our guests this week. The podcast was edited by Mark Towers and produced by Ryan Hewitt. Louisa Maycock provided additional research. The show was produced and written by Jake Cunningham and written and hosted by Steph Watts. That's me. If you have seen the film or enjoyed the podcast and are now thinking where you can get your next 18th century fix, there's still so much more to explore outside the frame.
Well, I guess people who are watching this film might want to start with the visual images from the period and the portraiture. I mean, I would just, if this film encourages people today to get more interested in women artists from the period, then that would be one very good outcome as far as I'm concerned. So if you're living in London, you don't have to go very far. Go to any one of the galleries in London and you're going to find the work of women artists who you may not be familiar with. I particularly would encourage people to check out Angelika Kaufmann, who was Swiss but spent most of her, a good deal of her working life actually in London and was a founder member of the Royal Academy in 1768. Her paintings are very like Marianne's in all sorts of ways, not just in terms of style, but in terms of theme. So I would definitely check her out. I'd also really encourage people to check out the literature of the period, because I think if people are surprised by some of the things in this film, they're going to be surprised by some of the 18th century novels that speak to the same issues. In the course of our conversation, Mary Wollstonecraft's name has come up a few times, and I think she would be a very good place to start. If you think people aren't really concerned about what we now recognise as feminism in the 18th century, then you'd be quickly corrected by looking at Mary Wollstonecraft's work, particularly her Vindication of the Rights of Woman, in which, amongst many other things, she totally rips apart Rousseau, who she really admires, but whose characterisation of Sophie in Emile she found deeply misogynist and just absolutely symptomatic of all that was wrong with the way that women were objectified in 18th century society. And of course, you know, that's one of the things that this film is challenging us to think about, is women's objectification both in the 18th century and now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.